one is now in session.
Thank you all. Please be seated. This is a time set for oral argument in our case number CACB 250722 Howell versus 918 Construction LLC. Each side is allocated 20 minutes for oral argument. Appellant, you may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if you wish to do so. If you wish to do so, please keep track of your own time at the podium clock. Out of respect for counsel and to avoid embarrassment, I would ask that everyone here make sure their cell phones are off so our proceedings are not interrupted. We've reviewed the briefs. We've conferenced the case. We'd appreciate it, and we'd encourage you, actually, to keep that in mind as you present oral argument today. Our proceedings are being recorded, and we'd ask that you, when you begin your presentation, tell us your name and the party that you represent. With that, Mr. Abney, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is David Abney, representing 918 Construction LLC. I'd like to apologize to the court for a typo that appeared in the opening brief and the reply brief. There was a section I was talking about companies that have similar names. One was Stanley that makes tools, and the other was Stanley that makes drinking cups, and I accidentally put drinking cops, C-O-P-S. And I don't think they make drinking cops. They just sort of anxiety and all that causes.
Spell checking sometimes is a devious sort of thing.
Spell check with flying colors.
Right, right.
I have three general kinds of arguments. We can address them in any order you want. One is a technical kind of argument, another is a fairness argument, and the last one is the damages argument. And the technical argument is really nitpicky. It's the default materials were not mailed to the proper place. They were mailed under the proper name. They were mailed to something that was described as 918 Constructions, LLC.
Mr. Abney, my last name is spelled somewhat unusually.
Yes.
If I'm out here in pulling my car out of the parking garage and I hit someone in the crosswalk and injure them, and then 6 months later a process server comes to my house and hands me a summons and complaint, John Doe or John Smith versus Andrew Beck, B-E-C-K, have I been served? Is the omission of the E rendered the service somehow defective? I mean, we all know, I expect that I'm going to get sued. I know I hit the guy in the crosswalk. This is not some sort of surprise. It's handed to me at my place of residence. Is the omission of that E somehow render the pleading or the service?
I would say technically yes.
Okay.
And I would not expect necessarily to win that. Technically yes. And that is really my technical argument.
Okay.
Part of the fringe to this, the frosting on this particular argument, before I pass on to something I hope is better baked, is that the member of the LLC, the statutory agent, had consulted, had talked with a lawyer. He said, oh, don't worry about it because it's not the proper name. And it's folly often to rely on lawyers that you don't hire and that don't really take the time to work up things and think things through, just give you an off-the-cuff. Anyway, I've made the technical argument in the opening brief and in the reply brief, and I have given it service here, and I'd like to move on to something more interesting, maybe.
Very well.
All right, there's a fairness argument, which should be the second smallest of the arguments. At the default proceedings, Marvin Groff shows up. He's the manager of this LLC, and he learns to his dismay that he is not allowed to talk. He manages to get in a little bit about, you know, they served the constructions instead of construction, and the court says basically no grandstanding, and he doesn't say anything else after that. He listens in, and everything goes downhill. So, and I believe that it is really a violation of fundamental process, fundamental fairness and due process, to have a proceeding like that where you inform a corporate representative who shows up that you can't do anything. Under the law, you can't say anything.
But he's not a member of the bar, and the law is pretty well established that you cannot represent an entity if you're not a member of the bar. Correct?
Among lawyers it is, although the first time I ever heard it, I thought, what in the world is that? But yeah, if you're a lawyer, you know this thoroughly, that you've got to have a lawyer hired to represent a company.
So let's say that you convinced us that that somehow that's unfair. What do we do with that? Because obviously we can't allow Mr. Groff to represent an LLC. The law does not permit that. So what do we do, and what should, in your mind, the trial judge have done in that situation?
The trial court should have said, we're not going to call a halt to the proceedings. Go get a lawyer, and we'll just reset this hearing. Let's be fair to everybody and do it that way.
Was there a request to do that?
No, he didn't do that. And there goes argument number two.
Well, and he did though, appear, right? Which sort of undercuts his thought that this additional S was completely out of bounds.
No, he thought he could do it. He didn't have any conception that he could not do that.
Right. My point's, though, different, that to the extent he viewed the S as being some other entity, why was he there?
He was concerned at that point that things were going downhill, so he wanted to show up and do what he could to fight
it. A fair concern,
yes.
A little late and without counsel.
Yes. All right. I admire the gentleman in my last argument. He talked about Audie Murphy, who was the most decorated American soldier in the Second World War. It was an unusually short man. He barely made it into the Army. And after the war, he became a movie star, mostly Westerns. And actually, some of them are quite good. And he was asked once, how was he so successful in the Army? He said, well, because I was so much shorter, there was less of me to shoot at. And this is one of those arguments where I wish I take Audie Murphy's advice to heart. But the best argument is the damages argument. And we had a very strange situation. You have the damages hearing, and Stephanie Howe comes in and testifies about their special damages, and she totals those up, and they come to a figure of $74,481. And then she says, and because comparable homes in the area sold for 1.7 to 1.9 million, and because I have this statistical market analysis, which I provided in the reply brief, laid it all out there, then the lost profits are $850,000. She's not a real estate expert. She doesn't have any basis for this other than a statistical analysis sort of stuff, and she's allowed to give that opinion. I think that was fundamental error for this case.
Can I take a step back, though, and just say and ask if they've gone through, if nobody shows up, you just disagree with the damages amount, why is that, I mean, why isn't that an appealable issue as opposed to we want to set this aside under Rule 60B, 60B1? Don't you have to show excusable neglect and then a meritorious defense? Do you have just an independent claim for I had a meritorious defense? Sorry, that wasn't a very well-articulated question. But let me just ask you, let's say you went to trial and the court just got it wrong. Can you come back 2 years later and say, I really had a better defense that wasn't presented. I want relief from this.
Didn't just get it wrong. Used fundamentally incorrect premises and procedures.
But can
to
you
that
do
figure.
That? You've had, we're 2 years down the road. Can you come back and say, I want to, under Rule 60B6, I had a meritorious defense that I didn't assert, and we want to revisit this. Is that what Rule 60B6 can be used for?
It could be used, I believe, for a fundamental error. And this is a fundamental error. The trial judge should have known that taking this kind of evidence was just simply wrong.
Mr. Abney,
there was no foundation for it at all.
This is an owner of property testifying about her own property, correct?
Correct.
The value of her own property.
I think I know where you're going.
You're
yes.
Going to Paradise Valley versus Laughlin, where the Supreme Court said a property owner is always competent to testify about the value of their own property. So,
I'm glad that you brought that up. When I was driving in today, I was thinking about that. Can an owner always testify about the value of their own property? And I thought to myself, you know, I've lived in the same home since 1986, raised my kids there, and I wouldn't sell it for $1 million, and it's not worth $1 million. But I would say if somebody said, what's the value of that house? I'd say $1 million. And I'd be allowed to testify to that. But that's not what she's doing. She's testifying based upon this market statistical market analysis and on comparable sales mm-hmm. to her opinion based on that concerning what the lost profits are.
So we have to nitpick through an owner's going to have all kinds of reasons for thinking their house is worth something.
Right.
The fact that they've looked at Zillow and have come up with some ideas of we're going to preclude the owner who's looked at Zillow from testifying, but we're not going to preclude the owner that's just happy that she raised her kids in the house from testifying to a number?
Yes, because the owner of the property is saying, I'm relying on these sources, and those are the kinds of things an expert relies on, not a homeowner. Homeowner could come in and say, well, my home is unique. I love it. We're never going to move. It's worth a huge amount of money, so, and could testify that way.
So your point is that she said too much. Had she merely said the diminution in value is $850,000 and said nothing more, that would be fine.
Right.
But because she added more, that's fundamental error. It turns fine to fundamental error.
Because now we know what the source of the information is. If she had just said, based upon my own feelings,
no,
this is the lost
property. I just want to make sure I understand your position, because that's a big swing.
Yes.
Okay.
And it doesn't just to take them.
That doesn't. So in your view, that makes that opinion inadmissible. It doesn't go to the weight of the opinion, but rather to the admissibility of that opinion.
Right. There's no basis for it. There's no fact. It's an expert opinion, is what she's given.
Well, aren't you?
And she can't do that.
Aren't you arguing it's an improper basis, not no basis? Because a property owner can provide a value without
a
basis.
It is. Well, technically, yes, it is an improper. There is no proper basis for that opinion. What she's done, she's yanked in the statistical analysis. She's yanked in the supposedly comparable sales and said, based on this, boom, $850,000. I think she took the value of the home, she took the sale price of the home, she looked at the comparables, she added in the specific damages, and then came up with a figure somewhere, and there's a lacuna there of about $850,000. She threw that in and she was done. You can't do that.
That all sounds like great cross-examination material, but when you're in default, that's kind of tough, isn't it?
It's brilliant cross-examination, Your Honor. Absolutely brilliant. I think I've actually made my to the extent I can, my points here. I can reserve my time, but I'm happy to answer questions. This is one of the thrills of my life is to be here answering questions.
Well, I'm curious about whether there is just an independent claim, and if you could come in, and maybe there's some timing concerns on setting aside a default judgment, but can we come in a year later and just say, wow, I wish I'd come in and done something different? Even if you've had an attorney who's been there at trial and they've just done a poor job, can you come in and say, you need to set this aside because I really had a good claim that could have been raised?
I believe there's some errors that are so fundamental that every trial judge ought to know is happening in front of them, that the trial judge needs to act independently and say, hold on here, you're not an expert.
We have that in criminal law, but what's your best case for that in this context? Here in civil law, if people don't like what their attorney did, they can go after their insurance carrier. There are some protections. I'm not aware of that concept being applied.
I think it's a good concept to migrate from criminal to civil.
Fair enough.
It just makes fundamental sense. If somebody comes in to you and says, Your Honor, I want $1 million for my home based on this statistical analysis, these comparable sales, which I've never established are comparable, by the way, and you would say, are you kidding me?
Well, but
this is not how we do things.
The trial court could have said that, and it didn't.
And should have.
Well, but you're not arguing that the damages number was zero. You're arguing that the number testified to didn't have a proper basis.
Right. And it's $850,000 just out of the ozone.
Well, actually, it's not just out of the ozone for the reasons we were talking. Had it been just out of the ozone, I think your argument kind of goes away. The improper basis, which is not out of the ozone, is what creates the issue, if I hear you right.
Possibly not right. The point being, there was no foundation, no basis for this $850,000 figure, unless an expert is saying it based on these other kind of things and expertise, of course. I know the market. I know how these things work. These are indeed comparable sales. The statistical market analysis is actually an accurate reflection under these circumstances of what the value was. That didn't happen. There was no expert. The trial judge just let this go forward. And I understand, to some extent, the extent I can, not never having been a judge, it's on these default hearings, you sort of want to grease the wheels and get the thing done.
They're not adversarial hearings in any real sense by the definition of a default hearing. But let me ask you, the ability of a property owner to testify to his or her, the value of his or her home, is that a evidentiary right or is that a substantive right?
It is such a strange idea, I think it must be a substantive right. I mean, this is my house. I get to tell you what it's worth.
Right.
Even if I'm a Looney Tune, I get to tell you what it's worth. It's like notices of claim. My son has, God forbid, died, and I'm certain has $1 billion.
Right.
Go eat a rock. That's what I want, and because it's my son. But there are certain areas where you can get away with that, but I don't think this is one of them. Not when you start saying statistical analysis, comparables, you're becoming an expert, and at that time, it needs to be shut down. Any other questions at this point?
Thank you.
I reserve my remaining time. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're fine. Thank you, Mr. Abney.
Mr. Collier.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Tim Collier. I represent the appellees in this matter, Stephanie Howell and, Todd Dickenhauer. May it please the court. From December 9th, 2024 to March 19th, 2025, appellant had every opportunity to be heard, contest service, or even answer to the matter. The same dates, from December 9th to March 19th, 2025, appellant had every opportunity to prepare and contest whatever it wanted to for the damages hearing. Instead, it rolled the dice on a misplaced S after the words construction and apparently on some what I would call poor advice from counsel. To basically,
is there anything in the record about this poor advice from counsel, an affidavit from this lawyer that I advised, you know, this company to not answer this complaint or not show up? I mean, do we have anything more substantial about that other than sort of what we've been presented with in the Rule 60 motion?
Your Honor, no, we don't. And in fact, we've asked. I even asked during the judgment debtor's examination, and we have never gotten the name of this phantom attorney. And maybe that's rightfully so as far as the attorney's concerned, if one does exactly exist. But as to those arguments and the misplaced S, the trial court here rightfully got it correct. Those very same arguments were presented at the trial court, which were rejected. And there was no abuse of discretion. There was no misinterpretation of the rules. And there was no lack of due process. As the court knows, obviously, this appeal is limited to what was presented in the motion to set aside in that briefing, as the notice of appeal is only as to the ruling and the denial of that motion to set aside. So I'd like to, if the court's indulgence, talk about a couple of admissions, what was actually as argued, and probably more importantly, what's missing from that motion to set aside that is in the opening brief and being asked this court to consider, which we would argue obviously was waived as it wasn't brought at the trial court level. First of all, the motion to set aside admits that Mr. Groff, as the statutory agent for 918 Construction LLC, was served with the complaint. I think through the progeny of the briefing and also the motion to set aside, it's undisputed that also all of the pleadings, the orders, went to 918 Construction statutory agent at the statutory agent address, which happens to be also Mr. Groff's personal residence. And I think in almost all in the instance of the complaint, he was served personally with that. It wasn't as somebody of suitable age. So we knock off basically two checks under 4.1. Not only was it served to the statutory agent, but actually the director and officer of the company.
Let's say we agree that there's no valid argument that there was a valid reason for not showing up. If you just go to the meritorious defense, is there kind of an independent basis for a meritorious defense argument under Rule 60b-6?
Well, the meritorious defense argument has actually evolved since the motion to set aside. In the motion to set aside, there's a very, very brief in passing statement about excessive damages. The main argument in the motion to set aside is that the ROC dismissed the case based on these
on the excusable neglect issue. But it did mention meritorious defense.
It did mention the meritorious defense. My point is the only meritorious defense in the actual argument in that motion to set aside is not one that's actually being presented to this court on appeal. It was about this ROC dismissal, and therefore essentially it didn't matter in this case at the lower court.
So they didn't raise anything about the excessive value of the...
Other than a brief mention. What's not in the motion to set aside is any mention of why it's excessive. In other words, there's no other market analysis. There's no other independent analysis. There's no even statement saying we believe the damages should be $100,000 based instead of the $850,000. There's just nothing like that in the motion to set aside. And frankly, there's nothing like that in the opening brief as well. There's no computation as to any sort of damages. And to one of Your Honor's points, it doesn't seem like the argument is that there shouldn't be any damage here. It's just that the $850,000 is excessive. I want to bring up the Schumacher case because I think this is very akin, and it was to this case, a memorandum decision by this Division One, and we were asking, and there's a lot of questions to Mr. Abney about Mrs. Howell's ability to testify. Well, I'd remind the court that in this case, in the Schumacher case, he was a property owner, just like Mrs. Howell. He rented that property. However, he didn't have much knowledge about it, quite frankly, because he had just purchased it through a trustee sale. So he went to Zillow, which, and also it's not clear through the case whether they're separate comparables or if they were part of the Zillow estimates. But nonetheless, Mr. Schumacher came in, not an expert, a brand new owner of this property, presented to the court to say, hey, these are the comparables. This is how a rule of thumb we determine rent. So there's no methodology there that an expert presented in the Schumacher case. A gentleman who happens to own property and rents it said, this is the rule of thumb. I don't even know if that's an accepted methodology or not, but nonetheless, the comparables generally are an accepted methodology for experts. Now, even though an expert didn't present in that case, and nor did it at the default hearing in this case, we saw through Schumacher, who also cites to the CSA 101-13B case, it's a very long citation, but it's cited in our answer, that comparables are sufficient evidence to determine the market value of a home. And one of the things the court did here, and one of the things, and let me just quote this real quick, Your Honors. This is from actually the CSA 13-101 Loop LLC case. It says, the trial court is given latitude to find a result anywhere between the highest and lowest estimate, which may be arrived by using the various factors appearing in testimony and any combination which is reasonable. None of these cases require an expert, first of all. But what the trial court did here is they looked at the statistic, the market analysis, the actual Exhibit 13, which is the core exhibit to Exhibit 16, which was really just a summation of all of the damages. But Exhibit 13 is this market analysis, and there are three properties listed there that are from $1.7 to $1.9 million. If you look at the square footages of those properties in that Exhibit 13, they are comparable to what the Howell property would have been had it been completed with the 1,000-foot addition.
Counsel, let me ask you, I understand your analysis, but that assumes that the testimony and the exhibits were admissible. And if I hear Mr. Abney right, he's saying they weren't. No objection, right, because there's nobody there to object. And he is arguing, therefore, that resulted in fundamental error, which is a ground under the rules of evidence, even when no timely specific objection is made. But did the testimony, was it 701 test? The rules of evidence applied to the default hearing, correct? Mm-hmm. Is that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Sorry.
Yes, they do.
My trial court days, I apologize. But if that was the case, was her testimony 701 lay opinion, or did it need to be 702 expert opinion?
It would have been lay opinion. She wasn't a qualified expert, obviously, right?
And if that's the case, though, doesn't 701 say that that evidence cannot rely on specialized scientific evidence, training, things like that? In other words, 701, I always thought, although not textually quite there, is mutually exclusive to 702. You can't do both.
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, the way I would answer that is a comparable is not necessarily a scientific methodology. It's a course of dealing in market or evaluations of property. Even appraisers use the comparables in the area.
They do, but they're 702 experts, not 701 experts.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And obviously, Your Honor brought up the Paradise Valley case as well, too, where a homeowner can obviously attest to the value of their property. In this case, Ms. Howell did her due diligence even above and beyond a normal property owner, in my opinion, to look at the market analysis in that area.
The market analysis is seems to just be square footage. And if you have an expert who comes in, they're going to do more than just the square footage. That there may be oddities about this house that would have resulted in it selling at a lower price than comparable sales. I mean, do we let a homeowner just give, just based on square footage, therefore that's the amount you have to accept?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the comparables in this case were equivalent to what the property would have been after the improvements and additions would have been done, 4 bedrooms, 3 baths. And so there's more to consider in the comparables, and when you look at that market analysis, just except in addition to the square footage. I brought the square footage up in part of my argument here just to say...
But square footage and number of bedrooms and bathrooms, as opposed to just an appraiser, an expert looking at the property, it may be a very weird design that that an appraiser wouldn't view in the same manner. And again, we just let the homeowner can just offer some data and then just form an opinion that's going to be accepted?
Well, that's what happened in Schumacher, and it was accepted. So I would answer the question, yes. It's been presented to this court, which the court opined upon. The other thing I would add, too, is that whenever there is knowledge that's within the common knowledge of the juror, then there's no expert needed. We see the case law for that. Well, now we have a presiding judge presiding over the case who's, you know, arguably seen these types of cases quite often, and people have presented comparables in order to determine the fair market value of the property. And so this court, within its discretion, probably looked at this property, the square footage, and the market analysis. The other thing to consider, too, is that this was a remodel, completely redone. As part of the record that we've demonstrated to this court, if you recall, Mr. Dickenhauer actually had to move to New Jersey for his job. Mm-hmm. And so what was going to be a remodel that they would be able to enjoy and live in for many years now turned into a remodel so they can sell it fair market value. So whoever was buying this house was getting essentially a brand new home. So arguably, inconsistent with CSA 13, although it might have been at the highest part of that evaluation.
Finish.
There's reasons in the record why it was towards the higher end, the 850 versus like a 650 if the comp was 1.7 million. My apologies.
You're fine. I apologize for interrupting you. Let's envision a world where Schumacher doesn't exist.
Well, I can't, Your Honor.
Well, no, we're in that world, or perhaps that it's not binding because it isn't. It's persuasive at most. But
sure.
I'm looking at 701, which I think we've established that was the testimony that was offered, and it talks about rationally based on the witness's perception, okay, homeowner, right? Helpful to clearly understand the witness's testimony to determine a fact and issue, right? We're good there because value. But then C, not based on scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge within the scope of 702, doesn't that run afoul when the market analysis comes in?
Well, in today's market and what's online, we can go to any app and we can look at what the values of properties are around us. I mean, I'm always looking at my properties and around my house to see what's sold, and
which is fair, but we're not calling you as a witness on that. And it may be useful to you individually, but whether it's admissible under the rules of evidence is sort of a separate question. Again, no objection, I get that. We're in fundamental error land, and that clouds at very least the analysis under 701. But I continue to struggle with that.
Well, and my point was going to be, Your Honor, is that what used to be specialized knowledge is really no longer specialized knowledge because it's accessible to the common consumer when purchasing a house. If you think back in the days, right, I mean, we didn't have access to these types of apps that were based on comparables and such. And so the only way to get this information would be through a real estate agent or an appraiser. Well, that's just not the case today.
Does that mean that an appraiser couldn't testify under 702 because... That's they don't need that specialized knowledge. I could suddenly become an expert witness simply because I can look at Zillow.
Interesting question. I don't know quite the answer to that. I mean, I think sometimes, maybe not under these circumstances, but in some cases we've had other mechanics come in and talk about whether or not you know, they believed the other mechanic did something wrong.
Sure, but right? That's what I refer to as the dirty hands mechanic, the expert that doesn't have a lot of initials by their name, but has worked 30 years and knows things based on their training and experience. That's clearly 702 land.
Well, and it could be, but again, we have the case law that a homeowner is able to testify, right?
And so if she had gotten up there and simply said, based on nothing at all, I think the number is 850 because I own this place, that's good enough, right?
In a default proceeding, maybe. I mean, you know, it's obviously a different mechanism, a different organism, but I struggle with that argument procedurally a little bit, right? I mean, you know, there's just no basis for that, and I think it doesn't, you know, pass muster on the mere speculation and conjecture in the case law, quite frankly. But we have more than that here. We have somebody who actually testified, did some research, and presented that to a court, amongst other exhibits.
Is the homeowner's ability to testify, and you've heard me ask this question of Mr. Abney, is that a substantive right, or is that a rule of evidence or evidentiary, you know, ability?
Well, I would say that in this appeal, it's been raised as both, because we saw comments such as hearsay and such in the opening brief as far as the actual Exhibit 13, the market analysis. Again, because of the nature of a default proceeding, you know, those objections weren't maintained at the trial court. But is it substantive as well? I think so. I mean, Ms. Howell had every right to testify to her belief of what the value of the property and amongst the other things that she testified to at the default hearing.
Was there any argument below that the contractor had no reason to know that they were going to sell the house? It seems like you contract for $350,000. I'm making up numbers. They don't do the work they're supposed to do. The damages would ordinarily be get your money back and whatever your incidentals for having to stay in a hotel type thing. It's kind of odd to tack on $850,000 because we had to sell the house this week.
Yeah, Your Honor, the appellant did know that the operation, if you will, had changed from being able to live in the house to them having to sell the house because of the nature of Mr. Dickenhauer's job. That's outlined a little bit in the Some Certain affidavit. It's also outlined a little bit in the complaint where they were actually providing additional amounts in order to try to get this done. I believe at one point there was an incentive actually presented by Mr. Dickenhauer to get the job done by July 4th. And of course, obviously it didn't get done. So the appellant was very much aware that the house was actually going to be put up for sale after the completion of the remodel and addition. I think you guys have quizzed me on everything I was going to say. The one thing that I will point out, I guess in addition, it's not the most, sexy of arguments, if you will, but there's this issue of the Some Certain affidavit with respect to the due process issue. And I just wanted to touch on that in my last couple of minutes here. My opinion of that and my argument to that is that it's moot because due process was provided. I think because the trial court actually set a default hearing. And in essence, they agreed with appellant saying, this is not a Some Certain affidavit. Please come in and present your damages. And so either it's moot at this point or appellant is not an aggrieved party with respect to the Some Certain affidavit. And the last point I'll make, and I know I said that was going to be the last one, but one more if you'll indulge me, is that the way I read appellant's opening brief and reply, and I don't mean to put words in their mouth, but they want you to look as far as the due process argument at the default hearing in a vacuum. What I think that ignores is the fact that 918 and its principal received everything, including the notice of the hearing, up until the time of the hearing and did absolutely nothing. That's where that opportunity to be heard exists, not just within the confines of the hearing. And I think Your Honor asked whether or not he actually made the request in the hearing, and he did not. And I think that's truly important as far as the due process argument that he did have many opportunity. And the other thing I'll add to that is there was a question about whether or not 918, the appellant, knew whether he should have counsel. Well, according to appellant, he sought the advice of counsel very early in the case and said, don't worry about it, you don't have to do anything here. Now, I don't know if that counsel was good advice or not, but at least appellant had the opportunity to go back to that counsel and say, do I need an attorney in order for the to present in this damages hearing or rebut the damages, or at the very least, it kind of puts you in the mind of Mr. Maverick Goff with respect to his company. He at least sought the counsel of an attorney very early on in the case. So he knew that 918 probably needed an attorney absent an S in that poor advice. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Collier. Mr. Abney, rebuttal.
I was just praying for inspiration, Your Honor.
Okay.
Sometimes it arrives.
My colleague across the aisle said, quote, she wasn't a qualified expert, end quote. And that's true. She was not a qualified expert. She didn't try to testify as what you could characterize as a 701 expert. She didn't just say, in my personal opinion, in my personal belief, this is a lost profit. No. She went on and said, no, there's a statistical analysis and there's comparables, and based upon that, I can calculate what the figure is, and it's $850,000.
Mr. Abney, could I get your response to some language from Paradise Valley versus Laughlin?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm quoting here from the case. The Arizona Supreme Court held in Board of Regents versus Cannon that an owner of property is always competent to testify as to the value of his property. Any explanation of the basis for his opinion of value goes to the weight of the evidence.
Correct. Sure.
Okay.
And that's fine. But
so here, isn't the explanation that I relied on Zillow or whatever, doesn't that simply go to the weight of the evidence, not to its admissibility?
No. I believe it goes to admissibility, because she's saying, look, here you've got this analysis, you've got these comparable sales. Based on those, this is the correct figure. She is testifying as an expert, and she's not qualified to do that. Even my colleague across the aisle admits that she's not qualified. So that was a fundamental error on the part of the trial court. Speaking of a representation, and maybe I'll make this argument in some other appeal where it will actually work, but I don't understand how the legislature can pass a law saying that if you're a company, your managers can't come in and represent you. I just don't get that. And I know it goes back to territorial days. It's a very old concept, very old statute, but I don't see how that really fits with due process of law. But it is what it is at this point.
And Mr. Abney, I don't think that's fairly in front of our court today.
No, it's not. Okay. It should be.
That's an upstairs argument, it sounds like.
The fundamental principle here is that you have to establish damages with reasonable certainty. And that $850,000 is not an item of damage that was ever established with any sort of reasonable certainty. You had no qualified expert, and she didn't phrase her opinion, and this is, I'm a homeowner and I get to say this is what it's worth. She didn't do that. She tried to become an expert, and the judge let it go. And that's not reasonable certainty. As far as this app business making everybody an expert, I fear apps and artificial intelligence from the bottom of my toes. Sooner or later, we're going to have AI writing our briefs and AI judging the briefs, and I don't know what the hell we'll be doing at that point. I think that's pretty... Oh, Schumacher, just a few points on that. The witness who testified in Schumacher was really the equivalent of an expert in that area. He was in the business of purchasing, selling, renting real estate, and he argued that the fair market rental value was this much based upon a percentage of the value of the property. And he also, he looked at the Zillow listings, but he did not rely on them in making his opinion. So I think Schumacher, to the extent that it matters at all, matters very little. Anything anybody would like to ask questions on?
Thank you.
Thank you once again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your briefing. We appreciate your argument today. We will take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a written ruling in due course. Court stands in recess.